watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
The dwindling of fossil fuel and its impacts on industrialized societies are usually described as a crisis. But it also provides an opportunity to remake society and heal ourselves while we heal what we have destroyed. This week on the program, Redesigning the Future. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFE Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQC Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Our speakers this week come from near and far. We'll begin with presentations from two conferences on peak oil that took place in the UK and Ireland last year. We'll begin by hearing the keynote address from the End of Oil Conference in London last fall, which was given by Member of Parliament and former Environment Minister Michael Meacher. Following him will be another speaker from that same conference, economist Richard Douthwaite. Here's Michael Meacher.
The scale of change required in the world economy in the next few decades, following the passing of peak oil within the next few years, is nothing less than apocalyptic. We perhaps forget that oil was not drilled, I think, until 1859 in Pennsylvania in the United States. And in the course of the time from then till now, roughly 135 years, we've used half, roughly, of what is widely believed to be the availability of oil, something like a trillion barrels. We therefore have about a trillion barrels left. But because of the phenomenal rate of growth of China and India, and let's not forget the Chinese and Indians constitute two-fifths of the whole of humanity, and with growth rates which would make our mouths water of 7 to 10% a year for several years now and probably extending quite a way into the future, the demand for oil is soaring, whereas the capacity to supply will, from now on, gradually reduce. Since our whole economy and our whole civilization is overwhelmingly dependent on oil, it's obvious that industry depends on oil. It's less obvious but true that the mechanization of agriculture and feeding the world depends overwhelmingly on oil too. Of course, transportation is dependent on oil. Cars and planes can't fly without oil. And what we perhaps might less take account of, military capability is absolutely dependent on oil. Just about everything that is important in our world. And the dislocation caused by the growing shortfall in availability is likely to produce consequences unprecedented in human history. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that. Fewer and fewer oil fields are now being discovered. Already four-fifths of the world's oil supply comes from fields discovered before 1970. And even if we were to find another field as large as Gawa, which is the largest in the world in Saudi Arabia, and that is virtually inconceivable given the huge improvements in geological knowledge in the last 30 years, it would only meet world demand for about another 10 years. That is the issue. The oil will start to run out. It won't be absolutely sudden like that. It won't be abrupt, but it'll begin seriously to reduce, probably within 30, 40 years. That's the issue. So what is to be done? Well, market forces, of course, will undoubtedly exert strong signals, but they are unlikely to be able to prevent abrupt dislocations without powerful accompanying strategies ruthlessly enforced against the vested interests. And my knowledge of government, not just the British, but of others that one's observed, makes one wonder whether that is likely to happen. We have consultants in the oil industry, there may be different views expressed on the platform, but predict that the likely shortfall will be some 9 million barrels a day by 2010. Let me just say that we use approximately 83 million barrels of oil a day at the present time. So a loss of 9 is pretty large, or a lack of availability of 9. And of course, the oil price will rise rapidly as the only way to reduce demand and almost certainly exceed $100 a barrel before that time. Considering we have already hit 70, that perhaps may be an underestimate. And of course, it will continue thereafter to rise steadily further. But that, of course, produces its problems. With the oil price rising very rapidly, the oil industry will undoubtedly look for less accessible, less easily produced sources of oil, notably tar sands in the North American continent, the Athabasca tar sands in Canada, on a very large scale. The problem with that is a double whammy. First of all, it is enormously more costly, actually, to produce oil from such unfavourable material. And secondly, the cost in greenhouse gases is likely to be enormous. I won't say that you can kiss goodbye to Kyoto Protocol, but it is certainly going to put a very severe pressure on what the world is allegedly trying to do as a result of the Kyoto Protocol. The effect, of course, on the heavily oil-dependent countries, there are 185 countries all roughly in the world, and the great majority, of course, do not have oil, and they will undoubtedly, as the oil goes from $100 to $150 a barrel or whatever, will be forced into a tailspin of decline, likely leading to violent uprisings. The human race is not terribly good at managing enormous dislocations of this kind, possibly revolution, certainly mass refugee movements on a scale that I think we have never seen. So it's pretty bleak. What proposals are there? Well, one which is put forward by Colin Campbell, he's not everyone's favourite person in the oil industry, but I happen to be a strong supporter of Colin Campbell. He proposes, and I mention this now because there is going to be a major international conference at Rimini in Italy in a fortnight's time in order to try and ratify this, he proposes the so-called Rimini Protocol, providing that importing countries cut their imports to match world depletion rate, that is, the annual production as a percentage of what is thought to be the amount of oil left. That's running at roughly 2.5% a year at the present time. Now, that is an ingenious suggestion. That would broadly bring consumption back into line. And I think it deserves to be taken very seriously. It means that poorer developing countries will be able to afford their minimal needs. Profiteering from shortage by the Middle East countries, by OPEC, would be largely avoided, and consumers would have just enough breathing space in order to avoid waste, to try and reduce waste, and by improving energy efficiency and a switch to renewables. The trouble is that, like all great ideas, there are always downsides. And the most obvious is, how is it going to be enforced? There is something of a parallel here, which is, of course, the Kyoto Protocol itself. I needn't go into the background of that, but the scientists believe that in order to stabilize global warming, we have to reduce the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, not by what Kyoto is proposing, which is a reduction of some 5%, but by around 60%. Or indeed, if we're going to allow the developing countries to develop, probably, and that requires some headroom in terms of their greenhouse gases from their industrialization, hopefully a cleaner one than ours, perhaps as much as 80%. Now, it's very easy to throw out these figures. Actually, getting your mind round what is actually involved in a change in our way of life, our civilization, and our economy from doing this is absolutely massive. Kyoto is a very small first step. A very important one, probably the most complex international negotiation in modern history, but it only involves 30 countries, and I've already said there are six times that number in the world, and it only involves a cut, if we're lucky, of 3-5%, nowhere near what is actually required. Above all, of course, it excludes the United States, the rogue country in the West, which has 5%, hope there are not too many Americans here, 5%, actually more Americans are actually on our side than one actually realises on this, and Mr. Bush is losing them fast. But 5% of the world's population and something like 25% of greenhouse gas emissions. But above all, what is really important is that Kyoto excludes China and India, and I've already talked about their rates of expansion, and they will equal the emissions of the West within 10 years. So it's not just our emissions, which we had to reduce, it is this colossal increase which is coming up from these major superpowers in Asia. There is also, of course, the point that since US political power derives from its economy, and given that its economic strength depends entirely on rapid growth and ready access to cheap energy, which might have something to do with the Iraq war, why should Bush sign up to Rimini any more than to Kyoto? Now, that is not an argument, it seems to me, for not advancing this, for saying to the governments of the world what is necessary to keep our use, consumption of oil, roughly in line with availability. But I must say I remain pessimistic about its options. It is unquestionably true that opinion is changing in America. California and New York are already imposing voluntary constraints on carbon. There are 150 mayors, like our local authorities, who are also doing the same. There are leaders in US industry, like Jeff Immelt in General Electric, who also believe in the necessity of controlling the use of carbon. But there is no question that other measures are also needed, and I'm going to try and mention four or five. Let me just start off by saying I don't believe that there is a technological magic bullet. That's what the US hankers after, what Mr. Bush would like to do, and I have to say I think that's what Mr. Blair would like to do. He's always telling us about improved R&D and increases in our technological capability. All of that's fine. I'm sure we'll do it. We're very good. We're an inventive race. But the idea that you can just continue with business as usual, just with improved R&D and improved technological capacity, I believe is fantasy. It requires far more profound structural change than that proposes. And I think we have to think about how we can construct the instruments for a transitional economy. We're not going to switch from oil to renewables, if that is where I think we're going or where we ought to be going. We're not suddenly going to do that. This is going to take a certain period of time, and realpolitik suggests that there are going to be some intervening steps. I think a bridge economy is more likely to shift to gas in the first instance rather than directly to renewables. I have to say gas, of course, is a risk too. In terms of Britain, the supply of gas from the North Sea, just like oil, is already declining. I think it's this year for the first time the UK has become a net importer of gas, and we will be getting 50% of our gas from abroad by 2010 and probably 80% by 2020. These are not my figures, these are DTI. So I think they're conservative, small C figures. When you say, where will that gas come from? Well, the answer is, I'm afraid, rather unstable countries like Algeria, Libya, the Middle East countries, Russia, etc., none of which can absolutely be relied on in a crisis. But having said that, gas could be refined directly into synthetic petrol and diesel for transportation. Though I have to say, I think that's probably not a major fuel source till perhaps sometime after 2010. Again, one important use of gas would be as a transitional feedstock to make hydrogen for fuel cells. That, I think, is much more significant. And fuel cells would slowly but steadily penetrate vehicle markets and stationary power markets and lay the groundwork for the eventual emergence of a hydrogen economy. I think that's extremely important. Once the technologies to make hydrogen from renewables, and here I'm thinking of solar, wind power, and of course clean coal, become cost competitive. And all of those, perhaps least with the question of wind, but in terms of solar and clean coal, are technologies that are by no means at this moment cost competitive. But that's the first point. Gas as a bridge economy, I think we need to look at very seriously. Secondly, we need a carbon penalty to be developed as a market mechanism. We've tried to do that in this country with the climate change levy on industry, imposing a penalty. We call it a levy because it's a tax, because we don't want the Tories talking about stealth taxes, but it is quite deliberately imposing a cost penalty on the excessive use of carbon in order to get heavy industry to reduce it. And I think there are some signs it's actually managed to do that. But a government, and here I suppose I'm thinking of the United States, could create a carbon budget for each industrial sector. Europe is already doing that with national allocation plans for each sector, which have to be submitted to the EU, starting, of course, with the worst offender, which is power generation, and setting up a carbon trading system, which, again, we are doing in the EU with an EU emissions trading scheme. I think the option also needs to be pursued of near-zero emissions clean coal power plant, but as I have to say, I think we're some way away from that, with carbon capture potential perhaps running by 2020. I think it's that sort of timescale. My third point is we have to do something, and it's rather limited, of course, about US extravagance. I'm sure everyone here is familiar that whatever you take, the index shows that the average American per capita uses vastly more resources, materials, and energy than the average for the planet or even the average for the West. And I think we need to begin to advance, perhaps privately, but also, I think, publicly, how this could be done as well. I think a no-holds-barred, multifaceted campaign needs to be launched to cut Americans' high consumption of oil and other energy. One mechanism could be what has been called a fee bait, a nice word. In other words, consumers buying a vehicle that gets 20 miles per gallon or less would have to pay a fee, which might be something in the order of $5,000 or £3,000, something like that, enough to make them think very hard about it. Whilst if you choose a car getting 40 miles per gallon or more, then you get a rebate of about the same size. Secondly, with regard to US R&D, there's no doubt the US has the capacity to put more money into R&D than anyone else. Well, heavy government investment in basic fuel cell research could speed the development of fuel cells for cars by resolving some of the still remaining critical engineering obstacles like reliability, like material cost, particularly platinum catalysts, and fuel storage issues. All of those, again, are areas where we could do a great deal more. My fourth point is the potential for conservation, and that is frankly absolutely prodigious. Since the volume of energy which we waste is almost unbelievable. Let me just give you a few examples. US power stations discard more waste energy than is required to power the entire Japanese economy. Secondly, only 15% of energy in a gallon of petrol actually reaches the wheels of a car. And only about a quarter of the energy used in a standard oven reaches the food. It has been even estimated that a mere 3 miles per gallon improvement in the fuel economy of US cars and light vehicles would be enough to forgo oil imports from the Gulf, which one might have thought was a better solution to the problem than starting an illegal and unprovoked war in Iraq. And if... I should always avoid making political points. I'm sorry about that. I couldn't resist it. I think it's true. If we could reduce energy intensity by just 3% a year, which is not enormous, and indeed I'm one of the sponsors of a bill before the House of Commons at the moment to seek to do exactly that, we could meet world demand in at the end of this century we're now in with only a quarter of the energy used today. The potential is absolutely enormous. And I have heard it said, I've never checked this, but since we had a mention, Ian, from you of nuclear and of this unwisdom of going down this route, let me say that affordable, practicable forms, a comprehensive programme of practical and affordable improvements in energy efficiency would actually produce extra energy equivalent to that produced by building 14 new nuclear power stations. And again, one might think that was a rather better way of solving our problem, given all the other problems about nuclear, which I'd like to go into, but I won't. The fifth is the potential for the global shift to renewables, and this is my last point. The main thing that is said against renewables is it's a very luxury sort of bolt-on. Everyone's in favour of it, even my opponent Brian Wilson, who's a very good colleague of both Ian and I. He's the pro-nuclear and I'm the anti-nuclear, and we're constantly head-to-head, and he's always saying he's very much in favour of renewables. I'm sure he is. But what, of course, he says is, well, it's just a very small thing. We should just bring them on. It's like a little sort of potted plant at the sort of side of the shed, and we give it a little bit of water from time to time and grow it a bit. It's only 3% at the present time. It's not serious, is it? Well, let me say the US Department of Energy, it's not some trendy left figures, the US Department of Energy estimates that three states only in the United States, namely North and South Dakota and Texas, have enough harnessable wind energy to meet the entire US electricity requirement. Tell that to President Bush. In the EU, it is similarly estimated that Europe's offshore wind potential in waters of 100 foot depth or less could supply all of the continent's wind power. And if you're looking to UK, we are very fortunate, though we don't often realise this in this respect. If you take the arc around the north of the country from Blackpool roughly on the west, around the top of Scotland and down to the Wash on the east coast of the North Sea, we have 40 times the whole wind capacity of the rest of Europe. And again, somewhere between 2 or 4 times the wind capacity to provide our entire electricity requirement. Okay, what about China? What about the new countries? Well, China has so much wind energy that it could double its national electricity generation by harnessing it. So don't let anyone say that the capacity of renewables is not there. The problem is the unwillingness of government to reduce those enormous subsidies that go to fossil fuels and nuclear and shift it into building the infrastructure which is needed to make renewables a viable alternative, not just for the UK, EU, but for the world economy. Now, with regard to solar power, where the price has already fallen tenfold since 1980, a recent study I saw by the accountants KPMG estimated that the construction of a 500-megawatt plant at a cost of about £700 million would bring the wholesale price down to that of conventional energy. Again, we are within striking range of harnessing solar power, not just solar panels for warming your water in your home, although I recommend people to think about that, but for much bigger projects than that. And with regard to fuel cells, even the Ford Motor Company, and I deliberately quote sources that are unlikely to be biased in my direction, the Ford Motor Company believes that hydrogen fuel cells will become the main power source for transport within 25 years. It is, if you look at what the oil companies themselves believe, what the motor companies are doing, it is all practicable. It is not as though the disaster that I was speaking about at the start is insuperable. It isn't. I conclude, therefore, that the energy economy by 2030 will be a hybrid of sorts, meeting demand with alternative fuels and improved energy efficiencies, yet still probably heavily dependent on hydrocarbons. However, maybe a cheaper vehicle fuel cell, for example, or a dramatically more efficient solar panel could completely change the path of our energy future. But none of that is going to happen without strong government intervention to propel the research and innovate the production. And as I always think, it is governments that are last to get the message. The question is, are we ready to take that risk and to press them down the only route by which I think we can save humanity? Thank you.
That was Michael Meacher, MP, speaking at the End of Oil Conference in London.
Richard Douthwaite is an economist and writer and has written on rural sustainability in his book Short Circuit. He is also responsible for formulating the book When the Wells Run Dry, which is an edited version of papers taken from the Transition to Renewable Energy, a conference that took place in Ireland in 2002. Richard's talk focuses on the positive aspects of oil price rises and the opportunity for change that many have been calling for in the realms of climate and energy. He stresses the need for a restructure in the existing model of global economic growth to a localized means of sustainable living. And he explains why the price of oil should be allowed to increase in order that society can meet the inevitable demands necessary for us to survive peak oil.
I was asked to talk about the silver lining because there was a feeling that we needed to get some sort of response to videos like The End of Suburbia or books with the title The Long Emergency or even The Party's Over. The idea that the oil peak is going to mean disaster. In fact, what I want to convince you of today is that it's a huge opportunity, and it's an opportunity for us to build the type of world that we've all been campaigning for. What it means, essentially, is that the business-as-usual scenario is no longer possible, and as Tim has just pointed out abundantly, it's not one that we want to continue anyway. I'm working on a project financed by the Irish government to take through decision makers in Ireland through the consequences of peak oil and how their sectors are going to have to change. At the beginning of June, we had a seminar for about 35 of them, and we presented them with four scenarios of the future running up to 50 years ahead. But we thought we'd concentrate, for the point of view of the meeting, on what would Ireland be like in 2015, 10 years ahead, because that's the sort of long-term planning in both government departments and business sectors. And we asked them to write headlines from newspapers of that time, and they were all gloomy. I mean, no business people wanted the type of society that, in fact, the system was creating. And what oil peak does is it gives us the chance to change everything. And we do have to change everything because the crises that we're facing, and the good thing about this conference is that it's bringing together two crises, twins, if you like, the climate crisis and the energy crisis. Oil peak then gives us the chance to change many of the things that are going wrong. I attended COP10, the International Climate Conference in Buenos Aires last December, and I put out a pamphlet there along the lines that I'm going to be talking this morning. And I went around to the International Energy Agency stall because it was dealing with linking oil peak with the climate crisis. And I'd heard from Colin Campbell that, in fact, the International Energy Agency had accepted the reality of a peak in conventional oil, not necessarily heavy oils and tar sands and this sort of thing, but in conventional oil. So I went to have a chat with them about what I was proposing. And I met one of their senior men, a man called Cedric Philibert, And he said, oh, no, 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 we don't see any crisis at all. The good news is that there is enough oil to enable expansion at 1.8% a year for the next 25 years. And he was saying this at a climate conference, which was entirely to do with limiting emissions. And yet the good news is, and why was it good news? Because we're locked into the growth paradigm. And this is one of the major things that is going to have to change. And it's taboo to mention it. And Andrew mentioned growth in his talk, but he didn't say it had to stop. But roughly half the energy used in a country like Britain goes into generating economic growth for the next year. If we had an economic system that enabled us to say, Britain is a wealthy country, one of the wealthiest in the world, we don't need to grow anymore. Now, we're rich beyond our wildest dreams, or at least our parents' wildest dreams. Let's stop. Let's do other things in life. Let's not be so fiercely competitive. There are a lot of other things that we could be doing. We could immediately cut our energy use by half. There's another figure is relevant to this and is relevant to a lot of what Tim was saying. There's an overlap between these two. Roughly half of all energy use goes into the transportation system. I mean, it's not just the 30% or so that is used to fuel the vehicles, the ships, the planes, and so on. It's the energy cost of building them, of building the roads for them, of building multi-story car parks, and it's the cost of the packaging materials and everything that goes along with it. If we had a more localised economy, then we could cut that figure radically too. So I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, that we can end energy use by ending transport and by ending growth, because there is a big overlap between those two. You're moving a lot of stuff around to create a growth economy. But we can end growth if we change the way the economy is structured. Why do we need a growing economy? Because of the way that we put money into circulation. What happens is almost all our money is lent into circulation. So if you have got money in your bank account and you don't sort of owe anybody anything, you've only got that money there because somebody else has borrowed it. And so what happens if the economy takes a downturn? We begin to think we better not borrow this year. Maybe, you know, it's not safe to buy a new car. Or the housing market in Britain has been flat for 18 months, so we don't need to rush to get onto the property ladder in the way that we did a few years ago. This means that we defer our borrowing. This means that last year's loans get repaid, but we're not taking out new money to replace them. And consequently, business conditions become difficult and the whole economy begins to wind down. Supposing we were to find a new way of putting money into the system, and James Robertson has published a book through the New Economics Foundation called Creating New Money, which in fact involves government spending money into circulation. So we've done the thinking, we know the way, but during the last election campaign and since, Tony Blair has been making statements that in fact we can't touch economic growth, we can't respond to the climate crisis because of the effects that it would have on growth. This is one of the major things that is going to have to be changed. But we work in a market economy. And Ted Trainer, an Australian writer, once defined a market economy as a market economy is an arrangement by which when things get to be scarce, only the rich get to have them. And what does this mean in the context that we're talking about at the moment? We've heard all morning that oil and gas are getting scarce. Are we going to leave their distribution to the tender mercies of the market economy? In wartime, in a crisis, and we've got a crisis now, what do good governments do? They ration them. Unless that happens, what will be the case is that the rich will continue, because they can afford it, to use a disproportionate amount of energy. The price will go up and up, and the poor, and this is already happening in Africa and around the world won't be able to afford their kerosene for cooking or to travel on buses. Africans are already having to walk because they just can't afford the new higher prices. But prices are going to go higher still. Don't think we've necessarily got a peak. I will come in a minute to what I think is the bad way of handling the crisis, and the one that's almost certain to happen. And that would mean bringing prices back down. But it would only be temporary. And if prices are to go on up and up because of scarcity, we need to put in place some arrangement that makes for a fair distribution, not only within single countries, but around the world. Fortunately, there has been a proposal, many of you will know it, that gives us the basis for making this sort of distribution. And of course, it's contraction and convergence. It was designed, as you'll all know, to share out emissions on a global level. Why don't we use it, in fact, to share out the right to use fossil fuel? Because that's essentially what emissions are. If we were to introduce contraction and convergence now, not primarily as a response to climate change, but as a response to oil peak, then everybody would get their own individual emissions entitlement, which would be tradable. So somebody in Africa who is using very little energy would get their emissions entitlement. It would be just like a foreign currency. They would take it to the post office and they would convert it into cash. The banking system, the financial system, would assemble the emissions permits. And people who wanted to buy carbon fuels, coal would have to be included in this, carbon fuels from a producer would not only have to produce the cash, but they would also have to produce the requisite number of emissions permits to cover that amount of fuel. And if we kept the level of emissions permits below the output level, if we were contracting, then this means that we can hit any climate target that we choose to go to. So that's what this conference is able to do. The danger is that, in fact, nothing will happen, that people will pretend that business as usual is still a viable proposition, and the central banks will mess it up. Jean-Claude Trichet, the head of the European Central Bank, came out with a statement at the end of last week, which buttressed the euro a bit, saying that he was going to come down heavily on the inflation produced by higher oil prices. What does this mean? This means that he is, in fact, stopping the necessary adjustments that need to be made in the price system. If we're to have a permanently higher level of energy prices. But that's what we need. If we're working with a market economy, we need the market to signal what we should be doing. We need the higher prices in fuel so that people make sensible decisions about insulation standards in the house that they're proposing to build or buy, or where they should live to minimise travel, so that businesses come up with better distribution systems, don't rely necessarily on shipping goods all around the world. Higher energy prices, because of its key role, the key effect that they will have on the transportation system, will give us the protection for local businesses that we've been wanting, but we've been told that it's sort of economically impossible because it's inefficient. I want to tell you about a man I know. His name is Ken May. He's a craftsman. He would like to build you a kitchen, and he would get great pleasure from building it for you from ash or oak that grows around where he lives, County Kildare in Ireland. But you wouldn't buy that kitchen from him, not unless you were really very rich, because you can get very much cheaper kitchens from a company called IKEA. And how does IKEA do it? Well, it has very dedicated automated equipment that takes in low-grade timber, churns it all up, you know, either cuts it into strips or uses chipboard, sticks it all together again, produces a limited range of items in each factory that it has, and then ships it all over Europe. In fact, it's gone into North America now. So the labour cost is quite low, the materials cost is quite low, but the transport cost is a very big element in it. So the balance that the business-as-usual scenario has created between a craftsman, a local craftsman like Ken, and IKEA is going to change in the future to Ken's advantage if higher energy prices work their way through. Every product has an energy content. So if we're to move to higher energy prices to encourage the transition to renewables, to make people think sensibly about decisions involving energy, then we need an inflation, because all prices need to go up, but they need to go up by differing amounts, and they need to go up by differing amounts over a long period. So if the Bank of England and the European Central Bank say, our job, the politicians have told us to stamp down on inflation, and if they go and do that, what they will do is they will jack up interest rates just at a time when businesses are facing higher energy costs anyway, and consumers are having to pay more for their energy, and consequently they've less to spend in other directions. And so all businesses' prices will go up, not by those two things, plus the cost of borrowing money. And it will cause investment to stop. That will cut energy demand back, because no building project will be going on. The demand for energy around the world will fall, and prices will drop back. But the market won't be signalling any longer that we need to change direction. So that's the bad way. That's the way of really making a crisis out of it. Energy is not going to be any more affordable for many people if it drops back to, say, $20 a barrel from the 60 or 60, 65 it is at the moment, because so many of them will be unemployed. What the banks are doing is trying to maintain the purchasing power of money in terms of energy without realising that energy is becoming scarce. It's obviously an inappropriate response to the crisis situation. If we can introduce an energy rationing internationally, we can not only ensure that the very poor at least have an energy permit that they can sell, and they get more for their energy permit than they're in fact paying in higher energy charges. We can also ensure that demand for energy is in balance with supply around the world, so the price can be moderated. We just mustn't fall back on this old way. And I want to end by telling you a story. I thought it was appropriate because my title is The Silver Lining, and I'm going to tell you about the Silver River. The Silver River runs from the Slieve Blue Mountains in Ireland, and people in this room really wouldn't call them mountains, they're just a bit of a hill, through the pastoral heart of Ireland until it joins the Shannon River. And I've been concerned with the development of a project in a village on that river. The story goes something like this. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. Once upon a time, there was a little river. It was a happy little river, and it rose in a range of hills in the centre of Ireland, and it gushed and bubbled over stones as it made its way down the hills to the plains below, and then it went on more slowly, winding its way amongst the pasture land. About 350 years ago, people came to the banks of the Silver River, and they began to use it. They dug channels, and they put mill wheels in the channels that they had dug, and they used the power of the river to do a huge range of things. There was a forge where they used a trip hammer to hammer out spades. They spun wool. They wove it. They ground corn. They rolled oats, which they grew in the surrounding field, and they fed to their horses or sent out into the towns and cities of the country. That was an energy crop that they were growing. They also took a beam and, with a cog, had a way of churning butter. So there were six mills on this little river. But what happened was, about 200 years ago, 400 miles across the sea in Lancashire, similar streams had been used for weaving and spinning. They found that under the soil there was coal, and They brought that up, they used it to make steam, and the Industrial Revolution got into its stride. And although initially industrial activities were close to where the energy was found, as oil came, as gas came, as electricity came, it was no longer necessary to have your industrial activities where energy was available, because energy was available everywhere. You could take it, you could move it around. So the mills beside the Silver River collapsed into disuse. The people left the area. The school closed 20 years ago. There are now only 12 occupied houses in that area. Initially, the work was done elsewhere in Ireland, but now the same activities are essentially being done far across the world in China. The point of me telling you this is that the thing about renewable energy, and Keith Tovey was making this point, with renewable energy, it's scattered everywhere. If you're burning biomass, it's not worth carrying it more than 10 miles because it's bulky. What you need is a combined heat and power system that is close to you, where both the electricity can be used, possibly by a direct wire system, and the heat can be used as well. If you took that biomass, as has been proposed in Ireland, and burnt it in a conventional power station, at best you would only get 40% of the energy in the wood out. The rest would be wasted, vented, spilt into the atmosphere with cooling towers. And then roughly 14% of the electricity that you create would be lost in distributing it through the grid. What we have here is the opportunity to build up a community energy system in the way that there once was. Because the conventional way of doing things is going to be too expensive. So that new higher level of energy prices has completely changed the economics of this. I only have Irish figures, but if you were to convert your oil-fired heating system to wood pellets, you can get a ton of wood pellets delivered in Ireland anywhere for €165 a ton. This is equivalent to 500 litres of fuel oil. The fuel oil is, as a result of the changes, twice as expensive as the wood pellets. So we have an opportunity facing us. It's not going to be solved by top-down solutions. It's going to be solved by people being empowered to do their own things. The power structures in the world will change from a few, the Seven Sisters, a few companies supplying the energy that we need downwards, to communities supplying the energy that they need themselves and linking up together to get a continuity of supply. It's a wonderful world we can create if we can present the vision of the alternatives that are open to us. There isn't a crisis, there's a wonderful opportunity. Thank you.
Richard Douthwaite, author of The Growth Illusion, How Economic Growth Has Enriched the Few, Impoverished the Many, and Endangered the Planet. He was speaking at the End of Oil Conference last fall in London. We'll take a musical break and in the second half of the program address redesigning society on the principles of Earth stewardship.
And on Friday I stood up and said I don't appreciate the speculation about Don Rumsfeld. He's doing a fine job. I strongly support him.
But what do you say to critics who believe that you're ignoring the advice of retired generals, military commanders, who say that there needs to be a change?
Corporation profits, bloody oil money. I'm above the law and I'll decide it's right or wrong. I am the egghead, I'm the commander, I'm the decider. Cuckoo, ca-choo, Baghdad City, policemen sitting pretty little targets in a row. See how they die when shrapnel flies, see mothers cry. I'm lying, I'm lying. I'm lying. I'm lying. Yellow cake uranium. Imaginary WMDs. They classify in facts, exposed in secret agent tax. That's for the wealthy leave and all the poor behind. I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider, cuckoo-ca-choo.
I'm the decider, and I decide what is best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of Defense.
Sitting in a White House garden, talking to the Lord. But my thoughts would be busy, busy hatching if I only had a brain. I am the egghead. I'm the commander. I'm the decider.
It's now listening to all voices. He writes the final decision. And Don Rumsfeld is doing a fine job. He's not only transforming the military, he's fighting a war on terror. He's helping us fight a war on terror. I have strong confidence in Don Rumsfeld. I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation. But I'm the decider, and I decide what is best. What's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain as the Secretary of
Defense. That was I'm the Decider by Paul Hipp. A true genius who has not only done an excellent parody, but actually improved upon the original. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. For the remainder of the program, we're going to talk about permaculture, a theory and practice of ecological systems design based on earth care, people care, and fair share that originated in Australia in the 1970s. We begin with one of its founders, David Holmgren, who spoke at Fueling the Future, the Challenge and Opportunity of Peak Oil, a conference held in Kinsale, Ireland, last year.
I want to really answer the question of what is permaculture and put that in a context of energy descent. I come from a village, small town, not so different to Kinsale, with a tourist economy in central Victoria, about 120 kilometres from Melbourne, where myself and my partner Sue Dennett, who's here with me, operate a small permaculture demonstration site that's also our family home, which is the views that you can see there. I suppose my work over the last few decades has very much been focusing on the bottom-up demonstration of permaculture as an alternative to the destructive dependent consumerism. And I want to sort of present that in a way that links that to this big issue. So to answer the question of what is permaculture, and also to see how it can help us live more lightly on the earth, because this is really what is required. Permaculture is a design system for sustainable living and land use, and this is really distinguishes it from thinking about production systems of organic agriculture, of many other technologies and applications, because permaculture is one step back from those. It's really a design system. It's really a thinking tool in many ways. But it's also become a grassroots and international movement of practitioners, designers and organisations. And we've just come from the 7th International Permaculture Convergence, which was in Croatia this year. The next one is going to be in Brazil in 2 years' time. You can think of permaculture as really being a process also for reclaiming our place in nature. Part of the problem in the current psychology that prevails in our culture is that we are separate from nature and not constrained by its limits. Clearly, energy peak and descent will smash once and for all that mistaken view. But what is also necessary is to realise that we are not some contradiction of nature, necessarily a destroyer of it, that we actually have a place in it and we can reclaim that place. And lastly, I see it as an empowering response to energy crisis. So just briefly, the permaculture concept started with work between myself and Bill Mollison in the mid-70s. And in a lot of ways, that work was part of that huge upwelling of interest in sustainable alternatives that coincided with the first and second oil shocks of the 1970s. There was a huge interest in a whole range of sustainable alternatives, an enormous interest in permaculture when Permaculture One was published in 1978. 10 years later, Bill Mollison's encyclopedic Permaculture Designer's Manual consolidated a lot of that permaculture work and rode in a way on another wave of interest in sustainable alternatives that was triggered by a different sense of environmental crisis, which was around the greenhouse effect. Of course, the perception was in the early 80s that the energy crisis problem just somehow evaporated. We now have a third wave of interest in permaculture, which is coinciding with basically both of these fundamental crises of climate change and energy and resource constraint coming together. The publication of my book, Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, in 2002 was definitely aimed to try and unpack some of the more fundamental ideas behind permaculture strategies and solutions, which inevitably, because of the popular culture grassroots base of those solutions, has been seen in the mainstream sustainability debate as slightly to one side, some alternative lifestyle sideshow, and not central to the big issues. I want to put this in context of how I see these future scenarios against the historical background of energy and resource use and resultant population and pollution mapped against historical time since the development of agriculture 10,000 years ago and accelerating up through the Industrial Revolution to the centre of the world, of course, in time-wise, the baby boom generation, me. And it more or less follows this pattern from pre-industrial sustainable society, climbing what I call the energy mountain through the period of industrialisation. And we can associate with that a culture of modernism in which this idea that progress was constant, that everything gets bigger and better, and many of the design principles embedded in our thinking were actually developed in this long period, which we can track back in many ways before tapping the big source of energy in oil to the emergence of capitalism and colonial structures out of Europe, tapping the untapped renewable resources of the world, moving on into coal and then into the very high-quality energies. And we have arrived at a climax which is really a postmodern cultural chaos about total uncertainty, about values, about the future, about meaning and purpose in society. If we project that through into the future, and rather than looking at that in years, thinking about it in terms of something that we can relate to, such as the great-grandchildren, and projecting further into the time it takes for an old-growth forest to develop. Not so long in future history compared with the timeline, the historical timeline. Over that time, I see four basic future scenarios. The first I characterise as techno-fantasy.